wider approach, I'm going to talk about the Dalembertian operator from which the cause and effect action arises, and then about the action, about Monte Carlo simulations you can do with the action, and a very interesting thing that we found out after the Monte Carlo simulations. I should thank you for inviting me and you all for being here. So, the first thing is a very short introduction to what a cause of set is. I guess here most of you know it, but it's always nice to be reminded. Then I talk about the Dalembertian, and then about the action and Monte Carlo simulations with the action. And then in the end I give a short introduction to some recent work that defines a local region in a cause of set. So,
pardon me, you just check if your microphone's turned on.
Okay, yes, it is definitely not. Okay, better?
Probably, yes.
Better, thanks.
Okay, cool.
I was warned about that too. Okay. Good, so that is my outline, and we have the first slide. So why does causality encode space-time, the key idea behind causal sets? Well, there were these results by Stephen Hawking and David Malamud that a bijective map between two past and future distinguishing space-times that preserves their causal structure is a conformal isomorphism. So if you have a Lorentzian space-time, and you can map it into another Lorentzian space-time, and the causal structure between them is exactly the same, every point that is in the past of point A in one space-time is also in the past of point A in the other space-time, then these two are isomorphic up to conformal transformations. That means up to local changes in the volume, kind of, the two will be the same. Then if we know the causal structure, all we really need is that volume element. And the insight was then, we can get that volume element if we just assume that space-time is discrete. If space-time is discrete and we associate a minimal volume to every event, then this discreteness can help us recover that volume element and the conformal transformation. So number plus order equals geometry, as Raphael Sorkin always says. Here's the definition of what a causal set is. Mathematically, it's just a partially ordered set. And it has to be reflexive. So, okay, first, maybe there's two ways to write the definition. You can use it with the reflexive condition, and this is precedes or equal, or you can only use precedes and then don't use reflexive, but it's equivalent. So it has to be reflexive, so each point precedes or is equal to itself. Obviously, it's equal. It's transitive, so if point x, say here, point 0 is in the past of point 2, point 2 is in the past of point 5, then 0 is also in the past of point 5 by transitivity. It's antisymmetric, so no closed time-like curves, and locally finite. Between any two points, between, say, 0 and 5, there's two other points in here. There can be any number, but it always has to be a finite number. So that is the locally finite. That's where the discreteness comes from. So one question. We saw that the causal set can encode space-time. The question is, how does a causal set look when it encodes space-time? Well, this is a picture of a very small two-dimensional space-time-like causal set. And a causal set is approximated by a manifold if we can faithfully embed it into that manifold. The embedding, we can call it faithful if it could arise with high probability through something that we call a Poisson sprinkling. A Poisson sprinkling means that we pick the points in the space-time according to a Poisson distribution. So this is the Poisson distribution. This gives the probability to have m points in the volume V if we sprinkle this a density rho. And so we pick these points and can then induce a partial order through the causal structure of the manifold. And this is a process how we can generate a causal set from any given manifold we have. It's more or less complicated. If you have a complicated manifold, then finding the volume for any region gets more complicated. It can be done, and it has been done for, I think, the most complicated thing known as a Schwarzschild black hole. So there are sprinklings into Schwarzschild black holes. So why don't we use the regular letters when we discretize space-time? So this is a cartoon. This is, of course, just a sketch of what it looks like. This is not the, don't take this picture too literally. So if we have a regular lattice, say we take a causal set where we take the points all in a distance A and here in two dimensions, take along light cones, and then we have this little region which contains four points. Well, what happens is if we try Lorentz transform it under a Lorentz boost, it's still the same set. Okay, I've cut off some sides because they would be out of the picture now, but it would still be the exactly same set, the same structure, but now we have regions that are immensely underdense, this region, or overdense, that is this region here. And this will always happen if we have a regular structure. A regular lattice will misbehave under Lorentz transformations. While if we have a random lattice, that is the other picture, the number of points in that red thing will remain approximately the same. That is because the number of points in our Poisson distribution is only dependent on the volume. So on average, the same volume should always have the same number of points. And that's why we can't use a regular lattice. One quick definition I wanted to show you is that of an Alexandrov interval. That is the space-time that is in between two points. In the causal set, it looks like this. All points Z that are in between X and Y. And we can also calculate it in Minkowski space, and then it will be this volume, only dependent on the proper time between the two points. I just wanted to flash it because I'll use this volume in some equations later. I think I will. So one especially interesting point about causal sets is that the graph of a causal set has infinite valency. Every causal set element has infinitely many nearest neighbors. If you think about it classically, it makes sense. If you take Lorentzian distance to determine a nearest neighbor, then the nearest neighbors of a point are all along its light cone. So in a Lorentzian metric, we always have infinitely many nearest neighbors. And that is why causal set graphs also will have infinitely many, or if we have a finite causal set, then at least very many, very high valency graphs. So that's one point in which causal sets are immensely different from other discretizations. That was my very short introduction. Any questions so far? Everybody is very quiet. Yes.
So here, the notion of this point is really fundamental.
Yes. Yes, the point is fundamental, a discrete event.
So it's like, it's a bit like a dust
particle. Yeah, I'm.
Because this comes from your picture of Lorentz transformation. You don't transform the points, but. Just
yes, it's the embedding of the points into a space time that I transform. And it should still be the same space time, no matter under which Lorentz transformation. But the coordinates of the points will be moving, and a regular lattice will then distort like that.
Yeah, so I'm asking whether there's kind of a new postulate that this point can be observed.
That is a very good question. There might be discreteness effects that allow indirect observation, but I don't know if there's.
What do you mean the point?
The point.
The
why not?
Yeah.
In principle, I mean.
I think it was another talk that has been in the question how we compare two different causal sets. And you know, it's basically when are two causal sets different? You can, you can imagine two very different causal sets describing the same manifold. And then it's still the question of two things and different.
Well,
yes.
I think the hope is that's not really the case. So if you have two different causal sets that are well approximated by the similarity of manifold, then you can never tell why one is realized in nature and the other one isn't. Okay. So you wouldn't want that to happen.
You wouldn't what? You wouldn't want them to be distinguishable even in principle? I mean, presumably, if you could do an experiment to distinguish them, you would destroy the manifold approximation.
Just like when you can
recognize an individual atom in a fluid, then the fluid approximation is not good anymore.
Yeah.
In there.
Yeah. I think I've imagine you take a causal set and you apply a call an active diffeomorphism. You get a different Hall set.
Well, you shouldn't think of the causal set as being embedded in the space-time.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's not clear what an active diffeomorphism would be in this case. Yeah, if it's a literal automorphism of the structure, then I guess it's the same.
But you would take all
then
the
it's the same causal set.
Yeah, maybe we can shift the rest of the discussion to the after the talk, because I think it's going away from the main topic of the talk.
Yeah, well, so, okay. The next thing is I'll talk about the D'Alembertian, which we use to define the action. So what maybe is a bit more familiar is if you have some simplicial complex and try to have some red point here and you want to discretize the D'Alembertian operator at this little point. And what you do is you take a kind of sum over the nearest neighbors of the point. So the difference between the point, the value of the field at the point and at the nearest neighbors, and you sum over that, and there's some volume factors. And that works very nicely in a simplicial complex. But you can see, I just told you, we have infinitely many nearest neighbors in a causal set. So if we try doing it in a causal set, we won't find a good result, because we sum over something infinite, and that would normally mean we would expect it to be infinite. So we have this point, and now we want to sum over all of its nearest neighbors in between here.
Just a sec. It's not a big deal, but in the last one, was that in that analogy you made, or the straw person you made? That one, yeah. Is it, that's for a positive definite? That's for a Euclidean metric, is it?
Yes, it
it's
is.
It's only for a Euclidean metric.
Yes, I don't know actually
do
how
they
you
have
do
one for the.
No, we had a discussion about that, that there's a difference because we take something that is explicitly Lorentzian and only sum over the past, while here you sum over all nearest neighbors. But I think it's a nice illustration of the difference, even so it's not one-to-one, really. So that's why. So in the causal set, we have infinitely many neighbors. And then the idea was that, well, so this is the two-dimensional case, which I'm illustrating here. So we have the value at the point itself, and then we sum over all nearest neighbors, and that will be infinite. But you can then subtract from that all next to nearest neighbors, and add again the next to nearest neighbors. So you take a combination of these layers, and that will then be finite. That is what Raphael found, and what Feydeauke and Dienici Benincasa also found works in higher dimensions. So instead of only taking the nearest neighbors, we also take next to nearest neighbors and next to nearest neighbors. And if we go to higher dimensions, we need even more layers. So the more dimensions, the more layers we need to include. And then we find that we get a D'Alembertian operator that works. So yeah, the idea is that we have some sum over the layers of a causal set. And we have these constants, alpha, beta, and ci, that we need to fix. We can fix them by just requiring that the operator works well for certain fields, certain very simple fields, where we can do the calculation analytically, and then we can find these constants. And we can actually write down this operator for any dimension now. And I have a closed form for alpha d and beta d. It should come up on the archive next week or so. I'm still in the process of fine-tuning that.
Is the sum still infinite? Is the sum of the nearest neighbors still infinite?
Yes. So this is a sum over which layer, so one layer to layer nd. And here we sum over all points in that layer. And this sum is the one that is still infinite. But what turns out, this ci have fluctuating sign, and the sum over the nearest, next to nearest layers actually leads to something finite. So there's some cancellation happening here that was very surprising.
So this definition is presumably non-unique, because you could imagine choosing different coefficients but then adding more layers. So this is the minimal number of layers that you have to take into account?
Yes, this is for the minimal number of layers, but there's also work in progress by whose name I always forget.
Us?
Yeah, by the. They are working on with how you can add more layers. And
because in the causal set case, you don't want to take the continuum limit. So any discreteness artifacts are physical in that sense. Mm-hmm. And so if you have very many different definitions of the version in principle, it could give you different results, right? So is there anything known on that?
No, it hasn't really been studied. So what I heard yesterday is that maybe there's some stability problems if you, depending on how many layers you take, that you need. But it's not been studied yet. So yeah, it's certainly a question we should look at some point.
So these coefficients are the same for any kind of discretization which you would take for infinity?
You mean they are the same for every causal set we apply the operator to?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. They change with the dimension,
mm-hmm.
but if we just take some causal, we will use the same operator on any causal set.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, this dimension dependence leads to that one crux that we need to know the dimension of the causal set. So we need to use maybe the Milheim-Meyer dimension or something to figure out what continuum dimension the causal set has approximately.
So you compute them on a regular causal set, and you have to tune these to get some finite result,
mm-hmm.
and you get some finite result on any other causal set.
So that's a conjecture that we would get something finite on a manifold-like causal set. Of course, the other point is we can only test it on finite causal sets, and there we will naturally find something finite.
So you have actually to predefine the dimension, whatever that means.
Yes, we need to find out the dimension first. That is something that is kind of worrisome if we want to use it for Monte Carlo simulations. Of course.
What kind of convergence properties does it have if you consider a finite, if you consider causal diamond, and then now you
mm-hmm.
consider a larger one that includes this one? How fast does it converge to?
So there's different terms that I think the next order is one over no. So it's the next higher order in L, I think. I'm not sure anymore, I'm sorry. I can tell you afterwards. I have it written down at least for three dimensions, and I can calculate it for any other dimension if there's any reason to. But I don't know right out of the top of my head. Okay.
So sorry, this has been verified for kind of finite regions in Minkowski space? Or
yes, we have simulations.
But
and
it's always in Minkowski space. Basically.
Yes, we have.
Some sprinkling.
Yes.
Okay.
There's actually something that happens when you use it in curved space time. That's when the action becomes interesting. I'll come to that in a moment. Yeah, we have tested it in. It's tested in 2, 3, 4 dimensions, I think.
But I think there are these analytic proofs in the continuum limit.
Yes, that. Yeah.
That
it would be. Yes, there's also that. But that's a paper that hasn't been really out yet, is it?
Oh, mm-hmm.
Isn't that Faith and Dion's paper where they. I think that's a paper that we were waiting for with my paper, which is why my paper only came out this year. And they haven't finished yet. But there are certainly some proofs about it, and it works. So, okay. Well, there's one more problem with this operator, actually. The problem is it fluctuates strongly. So if we apply the operator to several different causal sets that all approximate the same manifold, then on average it will be good. On average we'll get the right result. But the higher the density of our sprinkling, the more it will fluctuate, and that is a problem. But of course, I wouldn't tell you about this if we didn't have a solution. Well, maybe I would in the hopes that somebody comes up with it. But so the solution is Raphael's idea that introduce a second intermediate non-locality scale. We have one non-locality scale given by the fundamental discreteness scale of the space-time, and now we will introduce a second intermediate non-locality scale. And instead of using the next to nearest layer, the third layer, we'll use something that is mostly the third layer, but also a bit of the fourth and the second layer, and even a little bit of the first and the fifth layer. So we will kind of smoothen it out. We'll smear our function a bit over several layers along this intermediate non-locality scale to get a better result. The idea is that, of course, if we have a non-locality and a finite density of the sprinkling, then we will always have some points that are under-dense or over-dense. So the smearing out will take the edge off. The smearing out happens with this function. We know it for all dimensions with this CI, and epsilon is Planck length over the intermediate non-discreteness scale to the power of d. And here I drew this function for how the nth layer contribute. Yes, how the different things contribute to the nth layer. So the first will contribute with a negative to the nth layer. Wait, no, I'm sorry. No. Okay, for discrete, let me try this one again. So it's in seven dimensions, and this function is, this is how, if we had a scalar field of value 1, this function. Normally, we'd also have the scalar field in here with folded in. And this shows how the different layers will contribute. So the first layer is negative, then second layer is somewhat positive, third layer is here. So the contribution of the different layers, how we are smearing it out. Instead of having, if epsilon was 1, so we had the discreteness scale at the Planck scale, then this would be just, would just really be discrete points. And 1 would be down here, 2 would be up here, 3 would be down. So it would really be discrete. And now this is kind of with the smearing in this function. And if we introduce the smearing, then we can write the operator with this smearing. So this is nxy is which layer the point x is seen from the point, the point y is seen from the point x. That is our origin of where we calculate. And we sum over all elements in the causal past of x. And we can simulate the operator then. And this is what we find. So this is in three dimensions simulated for a 1,000 element causal set. So kind of a 10 by 10 by 10 box, if you want to think about it in the 3D. And we have tested it for the constant field 1, for x squared and t squared. And you see what is the expected value. And here's our simulation results. And this is actually very nice, because here, the Planck length over the intermediate discreteness scale is very, very large. The problem when we have this very, very large is that we should include points in the sum that do not show up in our very small causal set. Our causal set is 1,000 points. That means that very many things that we would use in our smeared out function will not actually be existing. So that is why we don't get very good results here. Then in the middle, with an intermediate smearing non-locality scale, we get nice results. And then when the non-locality scale goes down towards the Planck scale, that's what I told you, we get strong fluctuations about the mean. The mean is still nice. The simulation, if you look at the error bars, it's still pretty neat. But we have these large fluctuations. And I said 100,000 times sprinkled. So it's an average of 100,000, and that is our error bar. Yes.
So this non-locality scale of 2 times the Planck length, is this also sufficient to get the expression under control when you consider much larger causal sets? Or does the required epsilon somehow shift when you change the total size of the causal set?
We haven't checked that. I would think that it doesn't change, that actually this side will not change much. On this side, of course, we will get better results with larger causal sets, because more of the points that we should sum over will actually exist, and we will have them to sum over. But, it's just a conjecture.
Is it only the red points that have the error bars, or is it?
No, the blue and the green ones are very bad to see, because the error bars for these, here in blue you can see it a little bit. Here they are small still. They are smaller for green and blue. And here for the last one, they are actually larger, but they are kind of hidden a bit by the red. I don't know if you can see from approximately here to here is the blue error bar, and here to here is the green error bar. So the constant function seems to have the highest fluctuation. So I've told you a little bit about the D'Alembertian operator and how that works. And now we get to the interesting part, the causal set action that we can define from the operator. And even more interesting than the action, Monte Carlo simulations that can be done with the action. So now this is in a curved space-time, if we apply the operator to a scalar field, we will find some corrections proportional to the curvature scalar. There's actually higher order corrections, but they are suppressed by powers of the Planck, powers of the fundamental length scale. So in the limit of the fundamental length scale of our discreteness scale going to zero, these additional terms are suppressed, and that's why I didn't need to write them down and make it even larger. And to define an action, we can then just apply the operator to a constant field. Oh, actually, here's a typo. This should be a -1/2. Well, never mind. It's a constant, so, and it's dimension independent. We can actually prove that now. So we can apply the operator to a constant field and sum over all points in a region. And that will then be the same thing as integrating over the curvature scalar of that region. So we can define an action, and in two dimensions, that action will look like this. So I'm assuming that the discreteness scale is the Planck scale, else I would have some factors of G Newton. And this action is the number of points in the region minus twice the number of intervals of size zero. Intervals of size zero is two points which do not have anything in between. An Alexandrov neighborhood with two points that are linked, basically. Then plus 4 times n1, that is 2 points with exactly 1 point that is causally in between them. And n2 is, you guessed it, 2 points in between. This with 2 points in between, it starts getting more interesting because, 0 points, you always have only this. If you have 1 point in between, it will be like this. But if you have 2 points in between, you could have this, the chain, or you could have this, the diamond, where the two points in between are not related to each other. And then if you go to higher numbers, then you get even more possibilities how they can combine. So this works, of course, also in higher dimensions. So if we have d dimensions, we still apply it to 2 because the constant is dimension independent. And then the action includes this factor alpha d, beta d, and here's a constant. And you see, there's the dimension dependence of the action. That means if we want to use this action, we either kind of pre-choose the dimension by picking the action, or maybe we have to condition on what causal sets we sum. But it's very hard to do Monte Carlo simulations on causal sets, so I will talk about that. This is actually my slide about the action, so it's maybe a bit evil to talk about the action when that is all. The next thing is actually Monte Carlo simulations. So this is work by Simati Surya, and you can use that action now for Monte Carlo simulations. And her way to solve the problem of using Monte Carlo simulations in causal sets was by taking a special class of causal sets, so-called 2D orders. And we're good in time, so I'll actually show you what the 2D orders are. I can find my mouse. There we go. So my backup slide about the 2D orders. So what Sumati used as causal sets instead of She only summed over a subclass of causal sets, the so-called 2D orders. And to define a 2D order, you take U and V, which are two sets of elements from S, from 1 to N. And U and V are total orders, and proceeds is given with a natural ordering in S. And then the 2D order is the intersection of U and V. And that is actually like Lycon coordinates. That is like a kind of random grid in Lycon coordinates. We have then U and V and the element. So EI is UI and VI. And UI, and this EI is precedes EJ if UI, UJ, VI, UI precedes UJ, VI precedes VJ. So that's like some points in Lycon coordinates. And one of the major parts of Sumati's paper is actually proving that these give a good sampling over the space of causal sets, that this will include most of the interesting causal sets, and still also include enough non-interesting causal sets to show that the action does give some restrictions. And the nice thing is, if we use these 2D orders, then Monte Carlo moves are easy to define. Because on this 2D order, you can define a Monte Carlo move by just swapping UI versus UJ or VI versus VJ. So you can swap two of the points in one of the total orders, just, and you get a very nice Monte Carlo move that terminalizes quickly. If you have a general causal set without any given dimension or embedding, then Monte Carlo moves are very complicated. It's very hard to find Monte Carlo moves that terminalize the causal sets quickly. And like, you need months to terminalize, and David Reidert and I had a discussion because I disagree with him that it is terminalized. So terminalization of Monte Carlos is a bit of an art form. Okay, so back to the main track of the talk. Here we go.
Could you maybe draw this? So it seems like you pick a sort of set of U coordinates and a set of V coordinates, mm-hmm. and have everything that's sort of at the intersection. So you have a large, it seems like you have a kind of regular structure there.
That no, that's you because you have, okay, I'll. So, of course, U, V. Okay, not very regular now. The reason why you don't have a regular structure is because you have, so, 1, 2. So I'm just going to pick some with a kind of semi-randomness now. So then I have this one, 4, and 1, and 3. So the thing is that each of these points will only arise once. So you will have only one point that has, So you will have one point along this line only, and one point along this line. So
okay.
That is why it actually is a random order and does not give any regular letters.
Can you give an example of a non-manifold-like causal set that is a
completely I have a plot of one coming up in a moment from that, so that's probably better than if I try to draw it. So if you do these Monte Carlo simulations, what Sumati did, you find that you have two phases, actually. You have a phase one, which is the continuum, the good phase, the random phase, and the second phase, which are the non-manifold-like causal sets. And I have here some plots of this. So the phase one is a very nice random phase, and this phase two, not so nice. You see that this kind of grid structure, crystal structure, it looks a bit like the infamous KR orders of causal sets, but it's not quite. So you can see that this actually arises. So this is for high beta. So beta is inverse temperature. So this is for low temperature and relatively small non-locality scale. And you find that this actually comes as a minimizing the action in a kind of brute force way. And so you have these two different phases. This is in coordinates. And there was one other thing that showed up to that showed that we can distinguish these phases, and that is this. So we're counting the number of, Sumati found that if you count the number of subintervals of a given size, so you count how many zero intervals, one intervals, two intervals you have, and just plot that. So you plot the number of intervals of size zero, of size one, and so forth. You have this very nice red dots is from a phase one set, beta equals 0, 1. And the green ones are just a random sprinkling into Minkowski space. And you see that these two agree almost perfectly. While for the phase two causal sets, you see that it behaves like this. So it's very weird. And you can immediately tell that there's a difference between these causal sets from this interval abundance. And the interval abundance is what I'm going to talk about in my last section. But first, let me wrap up the Monte Carlo simulation by some open questions. So we need one thing that Sumati and I are going to examine now is how the phase transition behaves for different volumes. So Sumati tested everything with a causal set volume of 50 elements. That is in itself already impressive. 50 elements are good enough that you can find nice results and everything is not very badly fluctuating, and really it looks indicative. So 50 points are enough that speaks for the richness that causal set structure actually includes. And there's a phase transition between the two phases, and how does this phase transition behave with different volumes? That is something you want to test because that can give you indications of the order of the phase transition. And so this is a kind of teaser plot. This will, when we finish this ongoing work, we will hopefully have a better plot. What we're doing is a technique called blocking. So we simulate a 150 element causal set, that is this pink line, and a 100 element causal set, that is this red line, and a 50 element causal set, this green line. And then we coarse grain the 150 element causal set to 50 elements, that is this turquoise line. And we coarse grain the 100 element causal set to 50 elements, that is this blue line. And the thing is that the critical temperature should be the temperature where these three lines cross. Right now you might tell me, well, but they don't cross in one point. But then I'll tell you, well, I simulated 100 examples of each of these causal sets. This was a plot that I made to just test if my simulations are working. And it already is kind of the same area. Also, it's a very coarse step from 2 to 2.5 to 3. In the end, I will do more simulations and more steps in between, and then hopefully we'll find that they cross at one point, which would mean that there is really a phase transition between the two, and then I will have to read up more about what that actually means. Also, an interesting question but that cannot be answered with simulations is, does the random phase carry over to negative beta squared? So we have this phase diagram, so it's beta squared versus epsilon. And right now it looks as if the continuum phase is around zero. Here it gets very close to zero. So for negative beta squared, we would expect that we always have phase one, so that the quantum theory actually prefers the random phase, unless there's anything weird happening. But if anything weird happens or not has to be studied analytically, and we don't have any good idea how to do that at the moment. So
that's what you did, is you analytically continued in beta, right? So that negative beta squared is like I beta.
Exactly.
It's the physical value.
Exactly, that's a quantum theory, the real theory we want. And right now we only test the thermodynamic statistical theory, which gives nice results, but how if that carries over is a bit tricky too.
And what's plotted there? Is it say the action per point?
Yes, this is the action per point.
So
we
like
will
the
find
free energy, something like the free energy. Curve.
Yeah. We find similar behavior for most of these, but I picked the action per point because that gives a very nice and not too fluctuating, and it already gives a nice picture. Other things give less. Are you raising your hand in the back or just scratching?
No, sorry, I'm just scratching my hand.
Okay, sorry, good. So that was...
Sorry, just to ask a naive question again. What's the interpretation of the positive beta squared or, you know, statistical ensemble in this context? Physically, I mean, why would you consider it?
Well, it's kind of this usual argument that you do a statistical field theory if you can't do the quantum field theory, like you usually do if you do Monte Carlos, because to use Monte Carlo, you need some real weights, so you need to analytically continue and then somehow go back to the complex. And.
But you normally argue with the kind of Wick rotation there, right?
Yes.
But here everything stays a Lorentzian, I assume, or?
Yes, so we're not performing a Wick rotation on the set of causal sets. The set of causal sets are these 2D orders, and there is no way to Wick rotate them.
Sure.
We're doing a parameter Wick rotation. We kind of Wick rotate the... We introduce the temperature beta and kind of Wick rotate that. So that's how we're doing.
Can you go back to the classical theory? You have an action. What are the properties of this action? For instance, you take a family of causal sets, generally do some sprinkling. There's some variational principle. Can one find something I would call classical solutions? Is the action bounded from below?
That is a very good question. That would be interesting. I think the action is bounded from below, but that is more because we have finite causal sets. If we have an infinite causal set, I'm not sure. I don't know. It's certainly something somebody should think about. It would be interesting to do. I don't know how you would do it, maybe, because it's always hard to go to these things. But actually, I would.
If it approximates the gravitational action, you would expect that it might be unbounded.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
there are H issues. I mean, there is a K conformal factor of H.
But for instance, for a sprinkling or a mean cosmic space,
mm-hmm.
you expect that this action evaluates to something that is either zero or smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can modify a bit the. Your causal set, just some causal relations, how does it change? Does it?
So that's actually very difficult because you think you're just changing a few causal relations, mm-hmm. but that might change the structure of the causal set a lot. That's also one of the, yeah. Then you kind of run into the same problems as with Monte Carlo moves. What is a good way to modify the causal set? How do you do that? Because you're never going to have something that modifies it really locally because everything is so very interconnected. This high connectivity makes it complicated. But about the classical limit of it, let me comment on that in a moment because these are actually the number of intervals of a certain size. And the number of intervals of a certain size I showed you here gives us this interval abundance. And we actually calculated that. That is the last part of my talk. So I will make a comment on that in a moment.
But that beta in the formula has nothing to do with the beta, the temperature, is that right?
This, oh, you mean this beta?
No.
That is just unlucky coincidence of naming. So this is a beta d, so that's a constant. Dimension dependent, but constant. Yeah, I know the constant for all dimensions, if you want to ask me, but I'm not going to write it down now. Well, I had it on the slide, but I decided that it's too much for equations. Nobody is going to read it. So.
Is there some reason, just while you're on that, for separating out, not absorbing beta into the C? The C is a very simple form or something?
Well, the thing is that if you take the beta out, then C will be just integers for even dimensions and simple rational numbers for simplish rational numbers for odd dimensions. So, but it's basically just a convention. I define my CI for dimensions so that C1 in any dimension will always be 1. of course, you could as well take the beta d in there and then have slightly different constants. I just did it like this because it's convenient for me. So, the local region. Now I'm going to talk about the interval abundance and how we can actually use the interval abundance to test if regions in our causal set are local. So first, maybe about what is a local region in the causal set. So I picked out a little blue point here, and now I'm looking for Alexandrov neighborhoods around this point. And well, is this a local region around the point? Or this? Or this? Well, in the causal set, we can actually not tell which is which. We cannot tell which looks like what. Which, if it's flat, it's perfectly fine. If we have a flat, if we have Lorentzian space-time, then actually all of these neighborhoods around the point will be equivalent. I mean, so we could change from the long neighborhood to the smaller neighborhood of the same volume by Lorentz transformation if we had a flat space-time. The problem is if we have a curved space-time, the curvature will pick out a preferred frame, and then some of these regions, like this long one, would probe the curvature, while the smaller ones might not probe the curvature. So if we have some coordinate system, we can tell what is a local region. You would probably all intuitively say that maybe the not dotted black box is kind of local, while this very dotted box is very much not local. It doesn't look local to your intuition. But if you have it in the causal set, then all you know is the relations and the links between points, and then you can't tell which is which and which is local or not. And that is sometimes a bit problematic because we might want to look at some things only in local regions. But, I showed you before the interval abundance, and the interval abundance can help us. So first we can calculate the interval abundance. So the interval abundance, n, d of m, so in the number of m intervals in d dimensions depends on the density of the sprinkling and the volume, or we could also say the number of points in total because it will only arise as this. And so we need to solve this integral, and we can solve this integral. So we get this relatively nice hypergeometric function. So this is actually a shorthand for d terms. We have a for d minus 1 terms. We have a dfd hypergeometric function. And these are some Pochhammer symbols. And it's not pretty, but we can work with that. Mathematica can calculate that for us, give us numbers for it. We can count it. So that's maybe the point where I can comment on the action, because the action is just a sum over several of these functions. So we should actually try and put just these averages into the action and see what happens if we can.
This is flat on Minkowski
space. This is in flat space. Yeah, Minkowski. We can actually also, but that's work in progress, we can add a little curvature. We can here make an expansion in Riemann normal coordinates and then only keep first order in the curvature. But that is a long calculation and error prone, so we haven't really managed to finish to check that yet. And then we decided to leave it out of the paper for now. This is actually also published. I don't know if I have the reference in here or not. Might have forgotten, but Glaser and Soya, it's the only paper we have together so far. So, and we can calculate this, and even nicer, we can simulate it. We can simulate, these are 100 element causal sets in 2, 3, and 4 dimensions. The solid line is always the analytical one. There I just put the hypergeometric function Mathematica and calculated how many points would we expect for, how many zero intervals do we expect, how many 1, 2, 3, and so forth intervals do we expect. And these dots are, I simulated one sprinkled causal set. I just sat down, started up the cactus code, and clicked, set it to simulate one causal set, and I took the first one that came out. I did not pick these. There's no cherry picking involved. It really fits this well. These dotted lines around, that is kind of my approximation for a one sigma environment. Because I was lazy. I should probably check that it really is a one sigma environment. What it's now is, so the solid line is 400 elements, and the dotted line above is 410 elements. The dotted line below is for 90 elements. So it's for the, since we have a Poisson distribution, the volume average, the fluctuation around the average scale as the square root of the average. So we would expect fluctuations of square root n above and below. And that is what we see that works very well here. And I've tested it, we tested it in many different ways on many different things. I'm not going to show all of them now. Here's one of the tests we did. We sprinkled into a Friedman-Robertson-Walker or De Sitter space time. And it's a 1,000-point interval, and we averaged over 100 realizations. The error bars are not really the error, but the one sigma, the, it's not really the error, but the one sigma value. So this is, these error bars over 10, that would be the real error bars. But I wanted to compare, and so it's not so interesting here. Okay, so I'm rambling, sorry.
I mean, the real error bars would be too small to see, in other words.
Yes, but that's not the... So the main reason why I picked this is actually if I do 100 elements, or if I do in flat space and then compare the average, they will be almost exactly on the solid line. But also the fluctuation, the error bars from the one sigma, will almost exactly go from the dotted line above to the dotted line below. And I wanted to show that. That's why I picked this. So, but what we can see here is that if we sprinkle into a curved space time, then we have some subtle, some difference from the flat analytic case. And it's actually noticeable. So you can tell that this is actually in a curved space time. And we would hope that if we do the calculations in curved space time, they will, we will be able to follow this curve. So, but this is not the interesting plot. The interesting plot comes after explanation. So if we have, if our manifold is smooth, then any local region that's smaller than the curvature scale should be flat approximately. And so we would expect that large regions will probe the curvature, but we should be able to find small local regions that don't probe the curvature. Conversely, we should also find small local regions that do probe the curvature because they are very long and stretched out and somehow then see the curvature. And that is what we did. So I sprinkled a 10,000 element causal set into De Sitter space, and then I checked all 100 element sub-causal sets in this and looked at the interval abundance for them. And this is for De Sitter space, so the solid line is the analytic expression. The red line is one of the flat causal sets, the green line is one of the non-flat, and here I drew the red one and the green one into an interval that is kind of a caricature of my Alexandrov interval. So where it's very black, that means that there's a lot of density. This is trying to show the scale factor. And you can see that the red one looks more local than the green one. The green one is a lot at the edge. That is why it's not that long. And we can also test for the Friedman-Robertson-Walker.
Sorry,
with
the last one was De Sitter, you said?
Yes.
But in De Sitter, it has a Lorentz invariant. I mean, it's isotropic. So why would you expect to see differences between one and two? I mean, these subcausal sets, are they themselves intervals, or how were they chosen?
Yes, they are also intervals. Shouldn't they kind of?
I would have thought, because in De Sitter, any two points of the same, that are the same distance apart are equivalent to each other. I mean, there's an isometry that takes one into the other.
The points are not the same distance apart. It's the same volume in between them.
Any two points that have the same volume in between them.
Yeah.
In De Sitter, I would have thought that means that they have the same. There might be some discrete. I don't think so. But there, okay. I mean, conceivably there could be some discrete ambiguity, but I can't.
Okay.
I don't know. If you take an Alexandrov neighborhood in De Sitter, once you know its volume, shouldn't you know, shouldn't all those be equivalent by some isometry of decision, all those that have the same volume?
Mm-hmm.
So all pairs of points which have the same volume causally between them.
Now the volume only depends on the geodesic distance between them.
It only depends on the geodesic distance, mm-hmm. and if they have the same geodesic distance, then they should be equivalent
but
by the symmetry of the decision.
Okay. I don't know. I haven't thought about this.
But is there a boundary issue? I mean, you didn't do the whole. That's a conform. What is that picture? Why is there a boundary where the green is? Why does this picture have a boundary?
Well, the picture has a boundary because I'm only sprinkling into a part of De Sitter space, of course.
Oh, so maybe?
Into an Alexandrov neighborhood in De Sitter.
Oh, I see.
So. It might be that it
shouldn't anything because any two elements.
I mean, it could be that it is actually a.
Region, so it shouldn't affect this region.
Could be that it's a boundary issue since we see that they both go into the boundary here, but I don't know. I haven't used the code for the sprinkling and was very happy when I found the pretty results. So.
I mean, they all do look rather similar, but I don't see why they're not identical within fluctuations.
No, but, well, I don't know.
I think the fluctuations are the dotted line.
Yeah, so the dotted line is what we would expect as fluctuations.
Yeah, so maybe they are.
So that the green one is clearly above it. Well, more or less.
You think clearly above it?
I would say that the green line is pretty much above fluctuations. Well, okay, I've not. I'll have to read more about De Sitter space, clearly. So we also do the same in Friedman-Robertson-Walker space, and again find a longer one that is non-local and a red one that is local. And so Friedman-Robertson-Walker for W is equal 0, which is matter?
Dust.
And we also test.
It's where, spatially, or which? The spatial sections are.
Yeah, I.
Or what?
Then. I just picked W0 because it's dust.
No, I mean, but it could still be a dust in an open universe. It could be a spatially spherical universe or a spatially. Toroidal or flat or
it's an interval, so
it's this little k in the cosmology.
Oh,
k,
flat.
0, 1, or it's flat.
Yes, they are all flat. Mm-hmm. Yes. Sorry. Yeah, k is 0. And I also tested for radiation and
where
again.
Where's the analytic one? I mean the one that.
That's
the
black
space one.
The black one. The black. Solid line, which is a bit hard to see maybe behind the red one.
So it matches the red perfectly?
Yes. So the red is very good within fluctuations, while the blue one very clearly diverges.
That's analytic for the FRW? Or
no, that's for, analytic for flat space.
For flat space.
Because
the small intervals look flat.
Exactly. That was the argument here. So we can use this to determine what is a small interval that is local and not probing curvature.
It looks a little bit, I wouldn't jump up and down and say this, but it looks a little bit more than two. I mean, that looks a little bit more away from, the two curves are more clearly distinct, I think, than
yes.
in the De Sitter case, where hopefully they shouldn't really be distinct.
Yes, so maybe that is why De Sitter is not so good. But so here we have these very nice and okay, maybe De Sitter was a fluke. I'll have to look into that clearly. But here it's very nice. And so we're already at my summary and conclusion. So my summary is we have a D'Alembertian in D dimensions. I showed you how we motivate that and how we use it. And we can get an action from that D'Alembertian. We have an intermediate non-locality scale that arises. So maybe this intermediate non-locality scale that is needed in causal sets could lead to some kind of observational things. in two dimensions, we have Monte Carlo simulations with very nice results, and there is clearly more to come. And there's also attempts at Monte Carlo simulations in higher dimensions right now, but that is still in the working phase. And I gave you a very tentative definition of locality, of how we can talk about locality in a causal set, how we can tell if a bit of a causal set is local. This also gives us, of course, a good ruler to tell if a bit of a causal set is flat. It also tells us the dimension of the bit of the causal set that we're looking at, because I forgot to mention that here, but you can see that 2D, 3D, 4D, they are very, very different. So this is a very good dimension test, actually, that also tells us if the concept of a manifold dimension even makes sense to be applied to the causal set. I didn't show you now, but you can maybe see from here, if the causal set is not manifold-like, we find very, very different things. The behavior of the interval abundance, if it's not manifold-like, is very much different. So we also tested the Kleitmann-Rothschild orders, which are entropically dominant in the space of causal set. That looks very much like here, like these ones. So they are, their interval abundance looks very different from that from flat space. So it gives us something that might help us sort out causal sets that are not interesting. Okay, now back to the end. So yeah, open problems is using Monte Carlo in higher dimensions, phenomenological effect. There's other estimators for the curvature in the causal set, and one has been found by Sumati and her students. So we should compare the different estimators. What also hasn't really been done yet is checking the estimator for many different simulated causal sets. That's something that should be done. And well, there's a lot of things that we can do now that we know about locality. Being able to define a local region in the causal set. I think it might be useful for embedding of causal sets. I think the interval abundance might help there. If we know the local region of the causal set, we can define local regions, and there are some results about causal set topology that require knowing a local region. So now it should be able to use the locality for that and define more about topology of the spacetime the causal set embeds in. And I'm sure there's a lot of other things that can be done with this notion of locality that, yeah. So thank you for your attention. Any more questions?
We already had a lot of questions during the talk. Are there any more urgent questions right now?
Yeah, so I had two questions. So first, does the causal set action depend on our non-locality scale?
In some kind of intermediate way. So let me get to the relevant slide. So here I'm talking about the action, and here I have the non-locality scale. So if I have the action with a non-locality scale, which I can of course do, then I will have this function in here, and then, yes, the non-locality scale will show up. But it should give the same thing. It should, again, just smoothen out fluctuations.
I guess then my second question would be, have you studied the notion of locality that you got from doing the simulations in the different spaces and compare it with how it would be affected by this non-locality scale, if there's any relation between those two things?
No, I mean, these locality results are very fresh, so we haven't done much with it yet, but that could be very interesting to see if there's a connection.
Okay, if there are no further urgent questions, then I think we can continue our discussion over some cookies. And before, let's thank Lisa again.